refuses to face up to what he's got to face. The hero is more disciplined, and he fights those feelings off, and he does what he has to do. But they both feel the same, the hero and the coward. People who watch you judge you on what you do, not how you feel. Customato, legendary boxing trainer. When my partners and I meet with entrepreneurs, the two key characteristics that we look for are brilliance and courage. In my experience as CEO, I found that the most important decisions tested my courage far more than my intelligence. The right decision is often obvious, but the pressure to make the wrong decision can be overwhelming. It starts with small things. When founders come in to pitch our firm, one as the CEO and the other as president, the conversation often goes like this. Who's running the company? We are, they both say. Who makes the final decision? We do. How long do you expect to run that way? Forever. So you've decided to make it more difficult for every employee to get work done so that you don't have to decide who is in charge? Is that right? That usually results in silence. Intellectually, it should be clear that it is easier for employees to go to one decision maker than two. It's not really very complicated at all. Unfortunately, the clear and present social pressure often overwhelms the long-term benefits of organizing the company properly. Because the founders do not have the courage to decide who is in charge, every employee suffers the inconvenience of double approval. More important, decisions only get scarier as a company grows. When we decided to take LoudCloud public with only $2 million in revenue, it was not a hard choice intellectually. The alternative was to go bankrupt. It was nonetheless terrifying to do something that most employees, everyone in the press, and many investors thought was nuts. When making the right choice requires intelligence and courage. Sometimes the decision itself is rather complicated, which makes the courage challenge even more difficult. CEOs possess a different set of data, knowledge, and perspective than anybody else in the company. Frequently, some of the employees and board members are more experienced and more intelligent than the CEO. The only reason the CEO can make a better decision is her superior knowledge. To make matters worse, when a CEO faces a particularly difficult decision, she may have only a slight preference for one choice over another. Say, 54% kill a product line, 46% keep it. If the really smart people on the board and on her staff take the other side, her courage will be severely tested. How can she kill the product when she's not even sure if she's making the right decision and everyone is against her? If she's wrong, she will have been wrong in the face of advice from her top advisors. If she is right, will anybody even know? Recently, a large company offered to buy one of our portfolio companies. The deal was lucrative and compelling, given the portfolio company's progress to date and revenue level. The founder CEO, I'll call him Hamlet, not his real name, thought that selling did not make sense due to the giant market opportunity that he was pursuing. But he still wanted to make sure that he made the best possible choice for investors and employees. Hamlet wanted to reject the offer, but only marginally. To complicate matters, most of the management team and the board thought the opposite. It did not help that the board and the management team were far more experienced than Hamlet. As a result, Hamlet spent many sleepless nights worrying about whether he was right. He realized that it was impossible to know. This did not help him sleep. In the end, Hamlet made the best and most courageous decision he could and did not sell the company. I believe that will prove to be the defining moment of his career. Interestingly, as soon as Hamlet made the decision, the entire board and executive team immediately embraced the choice. Why? If they wanted to sell the company enough to advise the CEO to give up his dream, how could they reverse themselves so quickly? It turns out that the most important data point driving their earlier preference for selling the company was Hamlet's initial ambivalence. The team supported the decision they thought the CEO wanted. Hamlet did not realize this and interpreted their desire to sell to be the result of a thorough analysis. Luckily for everybody involved, he had the courage to make the right decision. The general problem can be seen in the social credit matrix to follow. The expected social rewards for making the crowd-influenced decision appear better than those for making the decision that you think is right. You decide against the crowd. You are right. Few remember that you made the decision, but the company succeeds. You are wrong. Everybody remembers the decision, and you are downgraded, ostracized, or fired. You decide with the crowd. You are right. Everyone who advised you remembers the decision and the company succeeds. You are wrong. You receive the minimum blame possible for getting it wrong, but the company suffers. On the surface, it appears that if the decision is a close call, it's much safer to go with the crowd. In reality, if you fall into this trap, the crowd will influence your thinking and make a 70-30 decision seem like a 51-49 decision. This is why courage is critical. Courage, like character, can be developed. In all the difficult decisions that I made through the course of running LoudCloud and Opsware, I never once felt brave. In fact, I often felt scared to death. I never lost those feelings, but after much practice, I learned to ignore them. That learning process might also be called the courage development process. In life, everybody faces choices between doing what's popular, easy, and wrong versus doing what's lonely, difficult, and right. These decisions intensify when you run a company because the consequences get magnified 1,000-fold. As in life, the excuses for CEOs making the wrong choice are always plentiful. Life excuse. Other smart people made the same mistake. CEO excuse. It was a close call. Life excuse. All my friends wanted to do it. CEO excuse. The team was against me, and I couldn't go against the team. Life excuse. All the cool kids are doing it. CEO excuse. It was industry best practice. I didn't realize it was illegal. Life excuse. It wasn't perfect, so I decided not to compete. CEO excuse. We never achieved total product market fit, so we never tried to sell our product. Every time you make the hard, correct decision, you become a bit more courageous. And every time you make the easy, wrong decision, you become a bit more cowardly. If you are CEO, these choices will lead to a courageous or cowardly company. Last thought. Over the past 10 years, technological advances have dramatically lowered the financial bar for starting a new company. But the courage bar for building a great company remains as high as it has ever been. Ones and Twos. Jim Collins, in his best-selling book, Good to Great, demonstrates through massive research and comprehensive analysis that when it comes to CEO succession, internal candidates dramatically outperform external candidates. The core reason is knowledge. Knowledge of technology, prior decisions, culture, personnel, and more tends to be far more difficult to acquire than the skills required to manage a larger organization. Collins does not, however, explain why internal candidates sometimes fail as well. I will attempt to do so here. I will focus the discussion on two core skills for running an organization. First, knowing what to do. Second, getting the company to do what you know. While being a great CEO requires both skills, most CEOs tend to be more comfortable with one or the other. I call managers who are happier setting the direction of the company ones, and those who more enjoy making the company perform at the highest level, twos. What ones like and don't like. Ones like spending most of their time gathering information from a broad variety of sources, from employees to customers to competitors. Ones love making decisions. Although they prefer to have comprehensive information when they make a decision, they comfortably make decisions with very little information when necessary. Ones have great strategic minds and enjoy nothing more than a good game of eight-dimensional chess against their best competitors. Ones sometimes get bored with many of the important execution details required to run a company, such as process design, goal setting, structured accountability, training, and performance management. Most founding CEOs tend to be ones. When founding CEOs fail, a significant reason is that they never invested the time to be competent enough in the two tasks to direct those activities effectively. The resulting companies become too chaotic to reach their full potential, and the CEO ends up being replaced. What twos like and don't like. Twos, on the other hand, thoroughly enjoy the process of making the company run well. They insist upon super clear goals and strongly prefer not to change goals or direction unless absolutely necessary. Twos like to participate in strategic discussions, but often have difficulty with the strategic thinking process itself. Where a one might be perfectly comfortable spending one day a week reading, studying, and thinking, doing so would make a two very nervous, because it would not feel like work to them. A two would get antsy at the thought of all the processes that might be improved, people who might be held accountable to achieving the standard, or sales calls that could be made while he was wasting time just thinking about strategy. Big decisions worry twos much more than they worry ones. Circumstances often force both ones and twos to make critical decisions with insufficient data, but ones generally feel fine about doing that and do not get overly anxious about the consequences. Twos, by contrast, can become highly agitated about such things and sometimes overcomplicate the decision-making process in order to provide a false feeling of thoroughness about the choice. CEOs who are twos, despite their love of action, can sometimes bring decision-making in a company to a halt. You need both characteristics to be a good CEO. While people tend to be ones or twos, with discipline and hard work, natural twos can be competent at one tasks, and ones can be competent at two tasks. If a CEO ignores the dimension of management she doesn't like, she generally fails. Ones end up in chaos, and twos fail to pivot when necessary. Functional ones. Often two executives act as ones for their functions, but twos as members of the executive team. For example, the head of sales might easily make all the decisions that are local to the sales organization, but prefer to take direction with respect to the overall company plans. This is the best kind of multiplayer leadership possible, because directions are clear and decisions are made rapidly with precision. How organizations tend to be constructed. The primary purpose of the organizational hierarchy in a company is decision-making efficiency. It follows that most CEOs tend to be ones. If the person at the top of the decision-making hierarchy doesn't like making extremely complex decisions, the company's processes will be slow and unwieldy. If you're a one, it can be counterproductive to have another one on your staff, because she will want to set her own direction rather than follow yours. This kind of strategic contention can confuse the organization and send employees in opposing directions. As a result, many great one CEOs employ primarily twos and functional ones on their staff. What happens at succession? This brings us to the question of succession. Since most organizations are run by ones and have a team of twos, sometimes functional ones, reporting to them, replacing the CEO can be extremely tricky. Do you promote someone from the executive staff, even though they are likely a two? Microsoft did this in 2000 when they replaced Bill Gates, a prototypical one, with Steve Ballmer, literally his number two. Or do you reach deep into the organization and pull a one from a level lower where they are likely to exist? General Electric famously did this with Jack Welch in 1981. It was an incredibly bold move by GE. Not only did they promote an executive two levels down in the organizational chart, past all of his superiors, but in doing so, they named the youngest CEO in the history of GE. It's difficult for most board members to even conceive of the possibility that there is a one deep in the organization who is more qualified to run the company than anyone on the executive staff. Both methods can be problematic. The first approach leaves the company in the charge of a two. As the company faces forks in the road, decision-making may slow down and the company may lose its edge. In addition, the natural ones, in Microsoft's case, stellar executives such as Paul Moritz and Brad Silverberg, will eventually leave. In scenario two, by promoting someone past everyone on the executive team and making them a CEO, as GE did, you will likely cause massive turnover of the executive staff. In fact, in very short order, almost none of the original GE executives remained under Welch. In a diversified conglomerate like GE, this kind of rough transition is possible. For companies in the highly dynamic technology business, the super high turnover scenario is more dangerous. The big conclusion. The big conclusion will be a big disappointment for those looking for an answer. The answer is, there is no easy answer. CEO transition is hard. If you bring people in from the outside, you lower your chances for success. If you promote from within, you must deal with the 1-2 phenomenon. Ideally, you'll promote a 1, and the rest of the executive team will be glad you did. Too bad things are rarely ideal. Follow the leader. There is no prototype for the perfect CEO. Radically different styles, think Steve Jobs, Bill Campbell, and Andy Grove, can all lead to great outcomes. Perhaps the most important attribute required to be a successful CEO is leadership. So what is leadership, and how do we think about it in the context of the CEO job? Are great leaders born or made? Most people define leadership in the same way that Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart famously defined pornography when he said, "I know it when I see it." For our purposes, we can generalize this to be the measure of the quality of a leader. The quantity, quality, and diversity of people who want to follow her. So what makes people want to follow a leader? We look for three key traits. The ability to articulate the vision. The right kind of ambition. The ability to achieve the vision. Let's take these in order. The ability to articulate the vision. The Steve Jobs attribute. Can the leader articulate a vision that's interesting, dynamic, and compelling? More important, can the leader do this and things fall apart? More specifically, when the company gets to a point when it does not make financial sense for any employee to continue working there, will the leader be able to articulate a vision that's compelling enough to make people stay? I believe Jobs' greatest achievement as a visionary leader was in getting so many super talented people to continue following him at Next long after the company lost its patina, and in getting the employees of Apple to buy into his vision when the company was weeks away from bankruptcy. It's difficult to imagine any other leader being so compelling that he could accomplish these goals back to back, and this is why we call this one the Steve Jobs attribute. The right kind of ambition, the Bill Campbell attribute. One of the biggest misperceptions in our society is that a prerequisite for becoming a CEO is to be selfish, ruthless, and callous. In fact, the opposite is true, and the reason is obvious. The first thing that any successful CEO must do is get really great people to work for her. Smart people do not want to work for people who do not have their interests in mind and in heart. Most of us have experienced this in our careers. A bright, ambitious, hard-working executive whom nobody good wants to work for and who, as a result, delivers performance far worse than one might imagine. Truly great leaders create an environment where the employees feel that the CEO cares more about the employees than she cares about herself. In this kind of environment, an amazing thing happens. A huge number of employees believe it's their company and behave accordingly. As the company grows large, these employees become quality control for the entire organization. They set the work standard that all future employees must live up to, as in, "Hey, you need to do a better job on that data sheet. You are screwing up my company." I call this characteristic the Bill Campbell attribute, after the man who is the best I've ever seen at this. If you talk to people who worked in any of the many organizations that Bill has run, they refer to those organizations as my organization or my company. A huge part of why he has been so remarkably strong in this dimension of leadership is that he's completely authentic. He would happily sacrifice his own economics, fame, glory, and rewards for his employees. When you talk to Bill, you get the feeling that he cares deeply about you and what you have to say, because he does. And all of that shows up in his actions and follow-through. The ability to achieve the vision. The Andy Grove attribute. The final leg of our leadership stool is competence. Pure and simple. If I buy into the vision and believe that the leader cares about me, do I think she can actually achieve the vision? Will I follow her into the jungle with no map forward or back and trust that she will get me out of there? I like to refer to this as the Andy Grove attribute. Andy Grove will always be my model of CEO competence. He earned a PhD in electrical engineering, wrote the best management book I've ever read, High Output Management, and tirelessly refined his craft. Not only did he write exceptional books on management, but he taught management classes at Intel throughout his tenure. In his classic book, Only the Paranoid Survive, Grove tells how he led Intel through the dramatic transition from the memory business to the microprocessor business. In making that change, he walked away from nearly all his revenue. He humbly credits others in the company with coming to the strategic conclusion before he did, but the credit for swiftly and successfully leading the company through the transition goes to Dr. Grove. Changing your primary business as a 16-year-old large public company raises a lot of questions. Andy describes an incident with one of his employees. One of them attacked me aggressively, asking, "Does it mean that you can conceive of Intel without being in the memory business?" I swallowed hard and said, "Yes, I guess I can." All hell broke loose. Despite shocking many of his best employees with this radical strategy, ultimately, the company trusted Andy. They trusted him to rebuild their company around an entirely new business. That trust turned out to be very well placed. So, are great leaders born or made? Let's look at this one attribute at a time. Articulating the vision. There is no question that some people are much better storytellers than others. However, it is also true that anybody can greatly improve in this area through focus and hard work. All CEOs should work on the vision component of leadership. Alignment of interests. I am not sure if the Bill Campbell attribute is impossible to learn, but I am pretty sure that it is impossible to teach. Of the three, this one most fits the bill, born, not made. Ability to achieve the vision. This attribute can absolutely be learned. Perhaps this is why Andy Grove's tolerance for incompetence was legendarily low. Indeed, the enemy of competence is sometimes confidence. A CEO should never be so confident that she stops improving her skills. In the end, some attributes of leadership can be improved more than others, but every CEO should work on all three. Furthermore, each attribute enhances all three. If people trust you, they will listen to your vision even if it is less articulate. If you are super competent, they will trust you and listen to you. If you can paint a brilliant vision, people will be patient with you as you learn the CEO skills and give you more leeway with respect to their interests. Peacetime CEO, wartime CEO. Bill Campbell always used to say to me, "Ben, you're the best CEO that I work with." This always seemed crazy to me, because he was working with Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, and Eric Schmidt at the time, while my company was going straight into the wall. One day I called him on it and said, "Bill, why would you say that? Do results not count?" He said, "There are lots of good peacetime CEOs and lots of good wartime CEOs, but almost no CEOs that can function in both peacetime and in wartime. You're a peacetime wartime CEO." By my calculation, I was a peacetime CEO for 3 days and wartime CEO for 8 years. I still have a hard time shaking the wartime flashbacks. I'm not the only one who has experienced this. Dennis Crowley, the founder of Foursquare, told me that he thinks about this tension between wartime and peacetime every day. The same goes for a lot of tech companies. For instance, When Eric Schmidt stepped down as CEO of Google and founder Larry Page took over, much of the news coverage focused on Page's ability to be the face of Google, since Page is far more shy and introverted than the gregarious and articulate Schmidt. While an interesting issue, this analysis misses the main point. Schmidt was much more than Google's frontman. As Google's peacetime chief executive, he led the greatest technology business expansion in the last 10 years. Larry Page, in contrast, seems to have determined that Google is moving into war, and he clearly intends to be a wartime CEO. This has been a profound change for Google and the entire high-tech industry. Definitions and examples. Peacetime in business means those times when a company has a large advantage over the competition in its core market, and its market is growing. In times of peace, the company can focus on expanding the market and reinforcing the company's strengths. In wartime, a company is fending off an imminent existential threat. Such a threat can come from a wide range of sources, including competition, dramatic macroeconomic change, market change, supply chain change, and so forth. The great wartime CEO, Andy Grove, marvelously describes the forces that can take a company from peacetime to wartime in his book, Only the Paranoid Survive. A classic peacetime mission is Google's effort to make the internet faster. Google's position in the search market is so dominant that they determined that anything that makes the internet faster accrues to their benefit, since it enables users to do more searches. As the clear market leader, they focus more on expanding the market than dealing with their search competitors. In contrast, a classic wartime mission was Andy Grove's drive to get out of the memory business in the mid-1980s due to an irrepressible threat from the Japanese semiconductor companies. In this mission, the competitive threat, which could have bankrupted the company, was so great that Intel had to exit its core business, which employed 80% of its staff. My greatest management discovery through the transition was that peacetime and wartime require radically different management styles. Interestingly, most management books describe peacetime CEO techniques, and very few describe wartime. For example, a basic principle in most management books is that you should never embarrass an employee in a public setting. On the other hand, in a room filled with people, Andy Grove once said to an employee who entered the meeting late, "All I have in this world is time, and you are wasting my time." Why such different approaches to management? In peacetime, leaders must maximize and broaden the current opportunity. As a result, peacetime leaders employ techniques to encourage broad-based creativity and contribution across a diverse set of possible objectives. In wartime, by contrast, the company typically has a single bullet in the chamber and must, at all costs, hit the target. The company's survival in wartime depends upon strict adherence and alignment to the mission. When Steve Jobs returned to Apple, the company was weeks away from bankruptcy, a classic wartime scenario. He needed everyone to move with precision and follow his exact plan. There was no room for individual creativity outside the core mission. In stark contrast, as Google achieved dominance in the search market, Google's management fostered peacetime innovation by enabling and even requiring every employee to spend 20% of their time on their own new projects. Peacetime and wartime management techniques can both be highly effective when employed in the right situations, but they are very different. The peacetime CEO does not resemble the wartime CEO. Peacetime CEO, wartime CEO. Peacetime CEO knows that proper protocol leads to winning. Wartime CEO violates protocol in order to win. Peacetime CEO focuses on the big picture and empowers her people to make detailed decisions. Wartime CEO cares about a speck of dust on a gnat's ass if it interferes with a prime directive. Peacetime CEO builds scalable, high-volume recruiting machines. Wartime CEO does that, but also builds HR organizations that can execute layoffs. Peacetime CEO spends time defining the culture. Wartime CEO lets the war define the culture. Peacetime CEO always has a contingency plan. Wartime CEO knows that sometimes you gotta roll a hard six. Peacetime CEO knows what to do with a big advantage. Wartime CEO is paranoid. Peacetime CEO strives not to use profanity. Wartime CEO sometimes uses profanity purposefully. Peacetime CEO thinks of the competition as other ships in a big ocean that may never engage. Wartime CEO thinks the competition is sneaking into our house and trying to kidnap our children. Peacetime CEO aims to expand the market. Wartime CEO aims to win the market. Peacetime CEO strives to tolerate deviations from the plan when coupled with effort and creativity. Wartime CEO is completely intolerant. Peacetime CEO does not raise her voice. Wartime CEO rarely speaks in a normal tone. Peacetime CEO works to minimize conflict. Wartime CEO heightens the contradictions. Peacetime CEO strives for broad-based buy-in. Wartime CEO neither indulges consensus building nor tolerates disagreements. Peacetime CEO sets big, hairy, audacious goals. Wartime CEO is too busy fighting the enemy to read management books written by consultants who have never managed a fruit stand. Peacetime CEO trains her employees to ensure satisfaction and career development. Wartime CEO trains her employees so they don't get their asses shot off in the battle. Peacetime CEO has rules like, we're going to exit all businesses where we're not number one or two. Wartime CEO often has no businesses that are number one or two, and therefore does not have the luxury of following that rule. Can a CEO be both? Can a CEO build the skill sets to lead in both peacetime and wartime? One could easily argue that I failed as a peacetime CEO, but succeeded as a wartime one. John Chambers had a great run as peacetime CEO of Cisco, but has struggled as Cisco has moved into war with Juniper, HP, and a range of new competitors. Steve Jobs, who employed a classical wartime management style, removed himself as CEO of Apple in the 1980s, during their longest period of peace, before coming back to Apple for a spectacular run more than a decade later, during their most intense war period. I believe that the answer is yes, but it's hard. Mastering both wartime and peacetime skill sets means understanding the many rules of management and knowing when to follow them and when to violate them. Be aware that management books tend to be written by management consultants who study successful companies during their times of peace. As a result, the resulting books describe the methods of peacetime CEOs. In fact, other than the books written by Andy Grove, I don't know of any management books that teach you how to manage in wartime like Steve Jobs or Andy Grove. Back to the beginning. It turned out that a little wartime was just what the doctor ordered for Google. Page's precise and exacting leadership has led to brilliant execution in integrating identity across Google's broad product line, from the rise of Android to brilliant new products like Google Glass. Sometimes you need to go to war. Making yourself a CEO. The other day, a friend of mine asked me whether CEOs were born or made. I said, that's kind of like asking if Jolly Ranchers are grown or made. CEO is an unnatural job. The surprised look on his face made me realize that perhaps it wasn't as obvious as I'd originally thought. Most people actually assume the opposite. CEOs are born, not made. I often listen as other venture capitalists and board members rapidly evaluate a founder and conclude that she's not CEO material. I am not sure how they figure these things out so fast. It generally takes years for a founder to develop the CEO skill set, and it is usually extremely difficult for me to tell whether she will make it. In athletics, some things, like becoming a sprinter, can be learned relatively quickly, because they start with a natural motion and refine it. Others, like boxing, take much longer to master, because they require lots of unnatural motions and lots of specific technique. For example, as I mentioned earlier, when going backward in boxing, it's critically important to pick up your back foot first, because if you get hit while walking backward the natural way, Picking up your front foot first, it often leads to getting knocked cold. Learning to make this unnatural motion feel natural takes a great deal of practice. If you do what feels most natural as a CEO, you may also get knocked cold. Being CEO requires lots of unnatural motion. From an evolutionary standpoint, it is natural to do things that make people like you. It enhances your chances for survival. Yet, to be a good CEO, in order to be liked in the long run, you must do many things that will upset people in the short run. Unnatural things. Even the most basic CEO building blocks will feel unnatural at first. If your buddy tells you a funny story, it would feel quite weird to evaluate her performance. It would be totally unnatural to say, "Gee, I thought that story really sucked. It had potential, but you were underwhelming on the build-up, and then you totally flubbed the punchline. I suggest that you go back, rework it, and present it to me again tomorrow." Doing so would be quite bizarre. But evaluating people's performances and constantly giving feedback is precisely what a CEO must do. If she doesn't, the more complex motions, such as writing reviews, taking away territory, handling politics, setting compensation, and firing people, will be either impossible or handled rather poorly. Giving feedback turns out to be the unnatural atomic building block atop which the unnatural skill set of management gets built. But how does one master the unnatural? The shit sandwich. A popular and sometimes effective technique for feedback beginners is something that experienced managers call the shit sandwich. The technique is marvelously described in the classic management text, The 1-Minute Manager. The basic idea is that people open up to feedback far more if you start by complimenting them. Slice of bread number one. Then you give them the difficult message, the shit. Then wrap up by reminding them how much you value their strengths. Slice of bread number two. The shit sandwich also has the positive effect of focusing the feedback on the behavior rather than the person, because you establish up front that you really value the person. This is a key concept in giving feedback. The shit sandwich can work well with junior employees, but has the following challenges. It tends to be overly formal. Because you have to pre-plan and script the sandwich to make it come out correctly, the process can feel formal and judgmental to the employee. After you do it a couple of times, it will lack authenticity. The employee will think, "Oh boy, she's complimenting me again. I know what's coming next, the shit." More senior executives will recognize the shit sandwich immediately, and it will have an instant negative effect. Early in my career, I attempted to deliver a carefully crafted shit sandwich to a senior employee, and she looked at me like I was a little kid and said, "Spare me the compliment, Ben, and just tell me what I did wrong." At that point, I thought I was definitely not born to be a CEO. The keys. To become elite at giving feedback, you must elevate yourself beyond a basic technique like the shit sandwich. You must develop a style that matches your own personality and values. Here are the keys to being effective. Be authentic. It's extremely important that you believe in the feedback that you give and not say anything to manipulate the recipient's feelings. You can't fake the funk. Come from the right place. It's important that you give people feedback because you want them to succeed and not because you want them to fail. If you really want someone to succeed, then make her feel it. Make her feel you. If she feels you and you are in her corner, then she will listen to you. Don't get personal. If you decide to fire somebody, fire her. Don't prepare her to get fired. Prepare her to succeed. If she doesn't take the feedback, that's a different conversation. Don't clown people in front of their peers. While it's okay to give certain kinds of feedback in a group setting, you should strive never to embarrass someone in front of their peers. If you do so, then your feedback will have little impact other than to cause the employee to be horribly ashamed and hate your guts. Feedback is not one size fits all. Everybody is different. Some employees are extremely sensitive to feedback, while others have particularly thick skin and often thick skulls. Stylistically, your tone should match the employee's personality, not your mood. Be direct, but not mean. Don't be obtuse. If you think somebody's presentation sucks, don't say, "It's really good, but could use one more pass to tighten up the conclusion." While it may seem harsh, it's much better to say, "I couldn't follow it, and I didn't understand your point, and here are the reasons why." Watered-down feedback can be worse than no feedback at all because it's deceptive and confusing to the recipient. But don't beat them up or attempt to show your superiority. Doing so will defeat your purpose, because when done properly, feedback is a dialogue, not a monologue. Feedback is a dialogue, not a monologue. You may be the CEO, and you may be telling somebody about something that you don't like or disagree with, but that doesn't mean you're right. Your employee should know more about her function than you. She should have more data than you. You may be wrong. As a result, your goal should be for your feedback to open up rather than close down discussion. Encourage people to challenge your judgment and argue the point to conclusion. Culturally, you want high standards thoroughly discussed. You want to apply tremendous pressure to get the highest quality thinking, yet be open enough to find out when you are wrong. High-frequency feedback. Once you've mastered the keys, you should practice what you've mastered all the time. As CEO, you should have an opinion on absolutely everything. You should have an opinion on every forecast, every product plan, every presentation, and even every comment. Let people know what you think. If you like someone's comment, give her the feedback. If you disagree, give her the feedback. Say what you think. Express yourself. This will have two critically important positive effects. Feedback won't be personal in your company. If the CEO constantly gives feedback, then everyone she interacts with will just get used to it. Nobody will think, "Gee, what did she really mean by that comment? Does she not like me?" Everybody will naturally focus on the issues, not an implicit random performance evaluation. People will become comfortable discussing bad news. If people get comfortable talking about what each other are doing wrong, then it will be very easy to talk about what the company is doing wrong. High-quality company cultures get their cue from data networking routing protocols. Bad news travels fast, and good news travels slowly. Low-quality company cultures take on the personality of the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wiz. "Don't nobody bring me no bad news." Making the CEO. Being CEO also requires a broad set of more advanced skills. But the key to reaching the advanced level and feeling like you were born to be CEO is mastering the unnatural. If you are a founder CEO and you feel awkward or incompetent when doing some of these things and believe there is no way that you'll be able to do it when your company is 100 or 1,000 people, welcome to the club. That's exactly how I felt. So did every CEO I've ever met. This is the process. This is how you get made. How to evaluate CEOs. No position in a company is more important than the CEO. And, as a result, no job gets more scrutiny. The job is so poorly defined that you can end up doing all kinds of nutty things, especially if you listen to some people who say things like, "The CEO should be the number one salesperson." Sadly, little of this analysis that's been done benefits CEOs, since most of the discussions happen behind their backs. Here, I want to take a step in the opposite direction. By describing how I evaluate CEOs, I'm at the same time describing what I think the job of the CEO is. Here are the key questions we ask. 1. Does the CEO know what to do? 2. Can the CEO get the company to do what she knows? 3. Did the CEO achieve the desired results against an appropriate set of objectives? 1. Does the CEO know what to do? One should interpret this question as broadly as possible. Does the CEO know what to do in all matters all the time? This includes matters of personnel, financing, product strategy, goal sizing, and marketing. At a macro level, does the CEO set the right strategy for the company and know its implications in every detail of the company? I evaluate two distinct facets of knowing what to do. Strategy. In good companies, the story and the strategy are the same thing. As a result, the proper output of all the strategic work is the story. Decision-making. At the detailed level, the output of knowing what to do is the speed and quality of the CEO's decisions. The strategy and the story. The CEO must set the context within which every employee operates. The context gives meaning to the specific work that people do, aligns interests, enables decision-making, and provides motivation. Well-structured goals and objectives contribute to the context, but they do not provide the whole story. More to the point, they are not the story. The story of the company goes beyond quarterly or annual goals and gets to the hardcore question of why. Why should I join this company? Why should I be excited to work here? Why should I buy its product? Why should I invest in the company? Why is the world better off as a result of this company's existence? When a company clearly articulates its story, the context for everyone, employees, partners, customers, investors, and the press becomes clear. When a company fails to tell its story, you hear phrases like, "These reporters don't get it." Who's responsible for the strategy in this company? We have great technology, but need marketing help. The CEO doesn't have to be the creator of the vision, nor does she have to be the creator of the story, but she must be the keeper of the vision and the story. As such, the CEO ensures that the company story is clear and compelling. The story is not the mission statement. The story does not have to be succinct. It is the story. Companies can take as long as they need to tell it, but they must tell it, and it must be compelling. A company without a story is usually a company without a strategy. Want to see a great company story? Read Jeff Bezos' 3-page letter he wrote to shareholders in 1997. In telling Amazon's story in this extended form, not as a mission statement, not as a tagline, Jeff got all the people who mattered on the same page as to what Amazon was about. Decision-making. Some employees make products, some make sales. The CEO makes decisions. Therefore, a CEO can most accurately be measured by the speed and quality of those decisions. Great decisions come from CEOs who display an elite mixture of intelligence, logic, and courage. As already noted, courage is particularly important, because every decision that a CEO makes is based on incomplete information. At the time of any given decision, the CEO will generally have less than 10% of the information typically present in the post-hoc Harvard Business School case study. As a result, the CEO must have the courage to bet the company on a direction, even though she does not know if the direction is right. The most difficult decisions, and often the most important, are difficult precisely because they will be deeply unpopular with the CEO's most important constituencies, employees, investors, and customers. The best decision that I made in my career, to sell Loud Cloud Business to EDS and become Opsware, would have lost by a landslide had I put it to a vote with my employees, my investors, or my customers. As CEO, there is never enough time to gather all information needed to make a decision. You must make hundreds of decisions, big and small, in the course of a typical week. You cannot simply stop all other activities to gather comprehensive data and do exhaustive analysis to make that single decision. Knowing this, you must continuously and systematically gather knowledge in the company's day-to-day activities so that you will have as much information as possible when the decision point arrives. In order to prepare to make any decision, you must systematically acquire the knowledge of everything that might impact any decision that you might make. Questions such as, what are the competitors likely to do? What's possible technically, and in what time frame? What are the true capabilities of the organization, and how can you maximize them? How much financial risk does this imply? What will the issues be, given your current product architecture? Will the employees be energized or despondent about this promotion? Great CEOs build exceptional strategies for gathering the required information continuously. They embed their quest for intelligence into all of their daily actions, from staff meetings to customer meetings to one-on-ones. Winning strategies are built on comprehensive knowledge gathered in every interaction the CEO has with an employee, a customer, a partner, or an investor. 2. Can the CEO get the company to do what she knows? If the CEO paints a compelling vision and makes fast, high-quality decisions, can she then get the company to execute her vision? The first ingredient in being able to do this is leadership. As I outlined in the section, follow the leader. In addition, executing well requires a broad set of operational skills. The larger the organization, the more elaborate the requisite skill set. In order for a company to execute a broad set of decisions and initiatives, it must have the capacity to do so. In other words, the company must contain the necessary talent in the right positions to execute the strategy. Be a place where every employee can get things accomplished. The employees must be motivated. Communication must be strong. The amount of common knowledge must be vast, and the context must be clear. Is the CEO building a world-class team? The CEO is responsible for the executive team, plus the fundamental interview and hiring processes for all employees. She must make sure the company sources the best candidates, and the screening processes yield the candidates with the right combination of talent and skills. Ensuring the quality of the team is a core part of running the company. Great CEOs constantly assess whether they are building the best team. The output of this capability is the quality of the team. It's important to note that team quality is tightly tied to the specific needs of the company and the challenges it faces at the point in time it faces them. As a result, it's quite possible that the executive team changes several times, but the team is high quality the entire way, and there is no attrition problem. Is it easy for employees to contribute to the mission? The second part of the evaluation determines whether the CEO can effectively run the company. To test this, I like to ask this question. How easy is it for any given individual contributor to get her job done? In well-run organizations, people can focus on their work as opposed to politics and bureaucratic procedures, and have confidence that if they get their work done, good things will happen both for the company and for them personally. By contrast, in a poorly run organization, people spend much of their time fighting organizational boundaries and broken processes. While it may be quite easy to describe, building a well-run organization requires a high level of skill. The skills required range from organizational design to performance management. They involve the incentive structure and the communication architecture that drive and enable every individual employee. When a CEO fails to scale, it's usually along this dimension. In practice, very few CEOs get an A on this particular test. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings put great effort into designing a system that enables employees to be maximally effective. His presentation of this design is called Reference Guide on Our Freedom and Responsibility Culture. It walks through what Netflix values in their employees, how they screen for those values during the interview process, how they reinforce those values, and how they scale the system as the number of employees grows. 3. Did the CEO achieve the desired results against an appropriate set of objectives? When measuring results against objectives, start by making sure the objectives are correct. CEOs who excel at board management can succeed by setting objectives artificially low. Great CEOs who fail to pay attention to board management can fail by setting objectives too high. Early in a company's development, objectives can be particularly misleading since nobody really knows the true size of the opportunity. Therefore, the first task in accurately measuring results is setting objectives correctly. I also try to keep in mind that the size and nature of the opportunity varies quite a bit across companies. Hoping that a hardware company can be as capital light as a consumer internet company, or trying to get Yelp to grow as fast as Twitter, doesn't make sense and can be quite destructive. CEOs should be evaluated against their company's opportunity, not somebody else's company. Let me share a funny story that illustrates a CEO really owning delivering against results. This story is from Robin Li, CEO of Baidu, China's biggest search engine company. In a lecture he gave at Stanford University in 2009, Robin recalls that on the day of Baidu's IPO, usually one of an entrepreneur's most exhilarating days in his entire life, he sat at his desk terrified. Why? Listen to how Robin owned delivering results. In 2004, we raised our last round of VC money, led by Draper Fisher Jurvetson and Google, one of our great colleagues. Then a year later in 2005, the company went public. The ideal price was $27, the stock's initial offer price, and it closed on the first day at $122. It was great for many of the Baidu employees and for all of the Baidu investors. It was a very miserable thing for me because when I decided to take the company public, I was only prepared to deliver financial results that matched the price of $27, or maybe a little higher, $30, $40. But I was really shocked to see that the price went to $122 on the first day. So that meant I needed to deliver real results that matched an expectation much, much higher than what I had prepared to do. But in any case, I thought I had no choice. So I put my head down and focused on operations, focused on technology, focused on the user's experience, and I delivered. Once we've taken all of this into account, we see that the results against objectives or black box results are a lagging indicator. And as they say in the mutual fund prospectuses, past performance is no guarantee of future results. The white box CEO evaluation criteria, does the CEO know what to do and can the CEO get the company to do it, will do a much better job of predicting the future. Closing thought. CEO evaluation need not be a Byzantine, unarticulated art. All people, including CEOs, will perform better on a test if they know the questions ahead of time. Chapter 8. First rule of entrepreneurship. There are no rules. That don't kill me can only make me a stronger. I need you to hurry up now. 'Cause I can't wait much longer. I know I got to be right now. 'Cause I can't get much longer. Man, I've been waiting all night now. That's how long I've been on you. Kanye West, Stronger. When we were in the process of selling Opsware, HP's initial bid came in at $14 per share. BMC countered with $14.05. Then HP countered them with $14.25. John O'Farrell and I planned our strategy for closing the bidding process. We figured that if we executed correctly, the winning bid would come in at $15 per share or higher. Everybody was extremely excited. Then disaster struck. Or more specifically, our auditor, Ernst & Young, nearly destroyed the deal. During BMC's diligence process, they discovered that we had accounted for three deals differently than they had. Specifically, each of our three deals contained something that had come to be known in the industry as the CA clause, in honor of the infamous software company Computer Associates, or CA for short. The CA clause had come about as a result of some of CA's business practices. Apparently, CA had tricked their customers by selling them maintenance contracts that gave them rights to free upgrades forever for products named X. CA would then change the name of product X to product Y and charge their customers for an upgrade the customers thought they were entitled to for free. It was very clever and totally dirty. To fight back, savvy customers started requiring all software vendors to include the CA clause in their contracts. The clause stated that if you released a new version of your software that contains all of the functionality of the previous version, plus some new features and a new name, then that product, despite the new name, would be covered under the existing contract with no additional fees due. There were two possible ways to interpret the CA clause. You could either interpret it as